On one side, two technicians sitting at computer screens connected to a huge array of hard drives. Three women and half a dozen men stood up to greet me. One of them extended his hand and introduced himself as the director. He was surprisingly young, but his long hair was completely gray, and I guess that the risk of ruining priceless works of art must have taken its toll. He said that, in the few hours since we had first spoken, the people gathered in the room had put together a strategy to try to recover an image from the mirrors. None of them, he said, held out much hope.
"Then again," he added with a smile, "sometimes even art restorers can work miracles. Ready?"
I nodded, and he flicked a switch on the wall. The four opaque walls turned completely clear. They were made from a type of glass called liquid crystal. An electrical current had rearranged the molecules and turned it transparent. We were standing in a glass cube, suspended in midair, looking down on a remarkable space. As big as a football field, and at least 60 feet high, arched, vaulted, and pure white, it was probably even older than the reign of the Medicis. Standing in it, dwarfed by the vast expanse, were hydraulic hoists for lifting monumental statues, gantries to raise and lower oil paintings, stainless steel cleaning baths big enough for an obelisk, and a steam room to remove centuries of grime from marble and stone. Moving between them were silent, battery-operated forklifts, small mobile cranes, and dozens of supervisors and specialists in white scrubs. Some workshop. It looked as if NASA had taken over the catacombs. Almost directly beneath me, a Titian was being cleaned, and not far away, men and women were working on a set of bronze doors by Bernini, which I had once seen at the Vatican. But most spectacular of all was a group of panels which had been joined seamlessly together and fixed to one wall. Produced from the huge photographic plates used in its restoration, it had been put there either as an inspiration or a memento of the facility's outstanding work. It showed Da Vinci's The Last Supper. It was life-size and as vivid as if it had been painted yesterday, and I had a fleeting sense of what it must have looked like 500 years ago to have entered the convent of Santa Maria delle Grazie and seen it for the first time. The director, putting on a wireless headset, pointed out two gilt frames standing against the wall. The mirrors had been removed, and both of them were hanging from an overhead crane. As we watched, it lowered them into a tank of blue liquid, a solvent which they were hoping would separate the film from the glass without damaging it. If it failed, or if the silver nitrate fell apart, we could all go home. Almost immediately, a large tent was lowered over the tank, blacking it out.
"If they can get the silver nitrate off, it has to be treated like a film negative. It can't be exposed to light," the director said.
I was consumed by doubt. What hope was there really? Sure, the Uffizi had restored Michelangelo's marble Pietà after a deranged Australian had taken a hammer to it, but even they didn't believe you could tease an image out of old mirrors. The director clamped the headset to his ear, listened for a moment, then turned to the rest of us.
"It worked. They've got the film off intact."
As the other smiled and clapped, he turned to me.
"They'll encase the film in a frozen slab of gelatin to stabilize it, then move it into the darkroom for processing."
2 minutes later, men in white scrubs wheeled a large trolley out of the tent and pushed it into a glass-sided freight elevator. I watched the two mirrors, wrapped in foil blankets, rise up. The elevator stopped at a block-like room, cantilevered over the vaulted space, which I guessed was the darkroom.
"It could take a while," the director said, "but once they've developed it, the technicians will be able to tell if the film has captured anything."
Chapter 28. I was sitting in the Uffizi staff canteen with the rest of the team, picking at a meal of espresso and more espresso, when the call came. The director took it on his cell phone, then turned to me, but spoke loud enough for everyone to hear.
"There's something on the film!"
We ran down white, silent corridors, past a startled group of wealthy donors being given a behind-the-scenes tour, into a freight elevator, and towards the conference room. Through its glass wall, we saw the technicians huddled around one of their two large computer screens, one of them at the keyboard, while the water-cooled hard drive spun fast. The director had kept up with me all the way.
Whatever they found on the silver nitrate will have to be digitized and put on the disk. That's what they're looking at.
We sprinted through the doors. The image of two people, just two people standing in the room, was all I needed. Anything to identify the visitor would be a bonus. There was nothing on the screen. Well, that wasn't exactly true. There was a darkness of varying shades, like looking at a pond on a moonless night. The director must have seen the distress on my face.
"Don't panic, not yet," he said. "They'll use the software to force the image, then try to fill in the missing microscopic dots from the surrounding fragments. It's the same method we use on damaged frescoes."
But I was panicking. He would have been too if he had known how much was really at stake. The young tech at the keyboard, his skin as white as the walls, was entering command after command. I looked at the intense, almost religious concentration on his face. He certainly hadn't given up, and that was comforting. Slowly, almost imperceptibly at first, but gathering pace as the hard drive spun even faster, a shape emerged from the dark ocean. I could tell from the warning lights blinking amber on a series of controllers that they were pushing the system close to its limits, but those guys weren't for turning either. I saw part of a room surface from the pond, fragments of a chandelier, the outline of windows looking out onto a view, the side of a fireplace. It was definitely the library in the French house, or la salle d'attente, or whatever other damn name anybody wanted to call it. I could barely believe it.
"I think we've got the person,"
the pale technician said over the clapping. He pointed at a section of the pond water, darker than the rest but containing a shadowy outline, cordoned it within an electronic grid, and poured in a constant barrage of light and pixels, and there was the leather armchair. I could see it. Hands sweating, despite the constant and relentless air conditioning, I could make out a blurred head, the crook of an arm, a part of the neck of a man in the chair. It was almost certainly Dodge. The text kept going. The warning lights drummed out an even faster beat, and the dark water surrounding the armchair sprang into sharper relief. Dodge was alone. Even so, the director and his team turned to me, elated, calling out in celebration. The plan which they had designed and implemented had been successful. They had recovered an image from an almost unheard-of medium. There was no doubt it was an outstanding achievement. Equally, there was no doubt it didn't help me at all.
"What's wrong?"
they asked, as they saw my face. I knew there was a man sitting in the chair. "I'm looking for another person. I need two people. What about the second mirror? It'll show the room from a different angle." We turned. The pale guy and his colleague already had the second image on the screen. You didn't need to be an expert in computer graphics to see it was far more degraded. The ocean of blackness was deeper, and the available light thin and full of shadow. We might as well have been underwater. The technicians moved faster. The darkness disappeared, and the guy at the keyboard once again dragged fragments of the library out of the depths. Parts of the chair and table emerged, but their shapes were far less distinct, and already the warning lights had hit the amber, and a few of them were starting to blink red. My hopes nosedived. The techs themselves looked disheartened, frequently glancing up to see more of the warning lights crossing over, and yet achieving no real improvement in the image. That was the trouble with luck, I figured. It runs out. I felt the director and other members of the team shoot glances at me, knowing how disappointed I must be, wondering how I was going to take it. All the lights were red, and I realized the techs had stopped trying to enhance the image. They had reached the limits of the technology. The half-formed image of the library hung on the screen like a quiet reminder of failure. The pale tech leaned closer to it, pointed at one section of the darkness, and said something in Italian I didn't understand. The director and the rest of the team peered at the spot he was indicating, but it was clear nobody could see anything. The tech, not very confident because he was doubting his own eyesight, dropped a grid over the section. Ignoring the red lights, he zoomed in on it, manipulated the pixels, and tried to coax the truth out of them. Nothing. His colleague stepped in and hit a command. The area under the grid inverted, the black becoming white, as if it were now a negative image. Suddenly, we could all see something. A vertical shape almost out of frame. The two techs worked together fast, pushing the software and the hard drives beyond their operating limits. Warning boxes popped up, but the guys canceled them out as soon as they appeared. The red lights weren't flashing. They were a solid bar. Still, the guys kept going, but there didn't appear to be any discernible improvement. A solid shape teasing us, that was all. Then, they turned the image back from the negative and removed the grid and the zoom. It was there. Indistinct, spectral-like, but the shape had become a person standing in front of the fireplace. It was impossible to distinguish anything specific, even if it was a man or a woman, but that didn't matter. There were definitely two people in that room. The director and his team stared at it for a moment, then cheered, while the two technicians got to their feet and hugged their colleagues. I pulled my eyes away from the screen, smiled, put my hands together, and applauded them all. They didn't know it. They would never know. But the Pathfinder was back in business. Chapter 29. I stepped through the oak doors and into a night so crisp and clear that the old cobblestones and Renaissance facades seemed almost too vivid, like the landscape of some strange video game. Only the crowds on the streets and the complete lack of taxis convinced me it was real. I had two calls to make and was waiting for the first to pick up as I headed past the workshop's exterior cameras and into a wide thoroughfare. Layla Kumali answered, and without any preamble, I told her I had a photo showing that Dodge and another person were in the library 6 minutes before he was killed. There was a stunned silence at the other end. I filled the empty space by telling her that the director of the Uffizi workshop was preparing a full report which he would send to her with a copy of the photograph.
"I'll let my colleagues know," she said finally, unable to keep the defeat out of her voice.
I was sure SpongeBob and his buddies were going to be overjoyed.
"It doesn't look like we have any choice," she continued. "We'll open a homicide investigation tonight."
"Good," I replied. "Good."
"How did you know Dodge wasn't alone?" she asked,
a little of the old disdain creeping back. "It was the drugs. And the binoculars. Nobody needs binoculars to look at fireworks."
"Then why did he have them?"
"You have to take it step by step. Somebody obviously knew how to get onto the estate in secret," I told her, still trying to find a damn cab. "They entered the house and found Dodge in the library. It was a friend of his, or at least an acquaintance. If it was a stranger, he would have raised the alarm. I'm almost certain the visitor was feigning distress. They told Dodge something that alarmed him enough to cut through his wild libido and the swirling craziness of the drugs."
"What did they tell him?"
she wanted to know, impatient. "If you reread the interviews you carried out with his acquaintances, at least six of them volunteered that he loved his wife very much."
"That's right," Kumali added.
"Cameron was out bar-hopping in the Jet Ranger that night. I think the visitor told him that the helicopter had just crashed in the bay." Silence. Kumali didn't respond. It was just a sharp intake of breath. "Dodge would have believed the visitor without question," I continued. "There's a landing pad on the estate, and he would have thought she was on her way home." Trying to sober up, he grabbed the binoculars to search the bay, and he and the visitor ran onto the lawn. He wasn't looking up at fireworks, he was looking out at the water. And the further he went onto the headland, the better chance he had of seeing something. That's why he chose the spot 4 yards from the gazebo. There wasn't any foliage, the only tree was the one he hit halfway down, and he had a much better view of the bay. When he couldn't see anything, why would he? There was nothing out there. He either stood on the railing or climbed over it. He would have had the binoculars to his eyes when he felt a push on his back. To the killer, it probably didn't even feel like murder. Just a gentle, helping hand. So gentle, in fact, that when you did the test with the dummy, it was totally consistent with a man falling. I let my voice trail away. There was no point in recounting his plunge down the cliff face and the hit on the rocks. There was no dispute about any of that. Kumali didn't respond, and finally I had to ask, "Are you still there?"
"I'm here," she said. "I'll make sure nobody's passport is returned. We'll start now. I'll draw up an expanded list of everyone he had contact with. Like you said, the visitor had to be somebody he knew."
"You can discount Cameron or the others in the helicopter. They couldn't have visited him in the house. They were supposed to be fighting for their lives in the water. And you were right. I don't think anybody was paid to do it. The answer lies in the circle of friends." There was another element to the murder she didn't know about, one she could never know. Call it a tiny signature, but it had made me really angry. I was certain that the thread from Dodge's chinos had been planted on the railing to make sure the cops would come to the right conclusion. A case in which the killer had followed exactly the same procedure was featured in my book. Chapter 30. I had finally located a cab when I heard the bad news. Having finished the phone call with Kumali, I had seen a vacant cab and dashed into the traffic to grab it. It was a miracle that any pedestrian could survive a horde of Italian drivers, but somehow I scrambled inside and asked the driver to take me to the airport. I was returning to Bodrum as fast as possible, and as soon as I had tightened my seatbelt, wishing it was a full racing harness given the way the guy was driving, I made the second phone call. It was to Ben Bradley. When he picked up, I told him I was in Florence. "We're back in business," I said, elated. "It's a murder. Let the other parties know."
"I've been trying to call you for 2 hours," he said.
"Sorry," I replied. "I had the battery out of my phone." There was only one reason he would have been calling, a message from Whisperer, and I knew that couldn't be good. He rattled on about the murder at the East Side Inn, but that was just camouflage, then mentioned that some colleagues of ours had run a series of tests, computer modeling, in fact, that I needed to know about. Ben didn't understand what he was saying. He was relaying a message, so there was no point in asking him questions. All I could do was listen with a sinking heart. He said that the guys had come up with an interesting date. They were saying 30th of September.
"But you know what computer geeks are like," he continued, and I got the feeling he was reading from a script. "It's hard to tie them down. They say you have to allow a 2-week contingency for any unforeseen problems. So they're saying the second week of October."
I hung up and sat very still, lost in thought for a long time. I knew from Ben's message that Whisperer had ordered a team to model, probably under the auspices of some war game, how long it would take a civilian to churn out a significant amount of smallpox virus using publicly available equipment. Working from that, they had calculated that it could be done by the end of September, and then added a couple of weeks' leeway. We had a date now. All time, all events, all hope was running to one point in time. Call it 12th of October, I told myself. Columbus Day. The anniversary of my mother's death. Chapter 31. When the customs officers opened the Saracen's well-worn luggage, they found neatly folded slacks, 2 dress shirts, a doctor's kit of a stethoscope and thermometer, a copy of the Holy Quran, and an English magazine. It wasn't The Economist or the British Medical Journal. It was called Bra Busters, and offered at least a D cup on every page. The 2 customs officers didn't say anything, but exchanged a look that spoke volumes. "Typical Muslim," they appeared to say. "Devout on the outside and, like everybody else, a dog on the inside." Had the men been a little more observant, they would have noticed that the holy book was zipped into a completely separate pocket of the carry-on, as if it had been quarantined from the filth with which it had been forced to travel. The Saracen had bought the magazine at the airport in Beirut in case German immigration had directed him to one of their interview rooms and put him through the hoops. The last thing he wanted was to look like a devout Muslim. The way the world had developed, if you had to cross a border, it was safer to be a hypocrite than a man of God. In the event, though, the magazine wasn't necessary. He had arrived at Frankfurt Airport, Europe's largest and busiest, at the height of the morning rush, just as he had planned. He knew from experience that a visitor was far less likely to be scrutinized when the lines were long and the immigration officers tired and overworked. After an hour in a queue, he presented himself to a young officer in a drab brown uniform. The man glanced at the photo in the Lebanese passport, then at the person smiling in front of him. Nice suit, beard trimmed to little more than a stubble, handsome face. A doctor, according to the arrival card he had filled in.
"The purpose of your visit?"
the young officer asked, first in German, and when that received a blank stare, in English.
"A medical conference,"
the Saracen replied. Apart from banking, Frankfurt's major commercial activity was hosting huge conventions and trade fairs, all at a specially constructed showground called the Messe. The Saracen produced the tickets and pass that he had purchased online and laid them on the desk. The officer barely looked at them, but the Saracen knew that it was the details, things like the girly magazine and, in Damascus, the dirt under the fingernails, which turned a legend into reality. The officer glanced at the return ticket, ran the passport through a scanner, and looked at the computer screen. Of course, it came back clear. The book was genuine, and that name had never been on any kind of watch list.
"How long will you be staying?" he asked.
2 weeks, the Saracen replied. "Maybe a little more, depends on how long the money lasts."
He smiled. The officer grunted and stamped the passport for 3 months. Everyone got 3 months. Even if the passport of a card-carrying member of Al-Qaeda had come back clear, he would have been given 3 months. Germany wanted its Messe visitors to stay. It liked the money they spent. Of course, the Saracen planned to stay longer than 2 weeks, but even if the immigration officer had just granted him the fortnight, it wouldn't have mattered. The Saracen knew what every illegal immigrant in the world was well aware of. Immigration enforcement in Europe was even more slack than border control. Keep your nose clean and your shoulder to the wheel, and you could stay as long as you wanted. The long-term future was fine, too. Every few years, they offered an amnesty. Where was the incentive ever to leave? The Saracen picked up his bag from the carousel, suffered the indignity of seeing the snide glance between the customs officers, was sent on his way, and walked into the curbside chaos of the huge airport. Squeezing along the sidewalk, he dumped the girly magazine and its temptations into a trash can, found a bus to take him into the city, and vanished into the alternate universe of Islamic Europe. It was a strange world, one which I had experienced when I was stationed in Europe. Chasing down leads and contacts on a dozen different cases, I had walked through scores of grim industrial cities and visited the countless Stalinist-style housing estates on their outskirts. But for anyone who hadn't seen such places, it would have been hard to credit the gradual transformation that had taken place. The most common name for a baby born in Belgium was now Mohammed. 3 million Turkish Muslims lived in Germany alone. Almost 10% of the population of France were followers of Islam. As a Swiss writer once said, "We wanted a labor force, but human beings came." And what nobody had foreseen was that those workers would bring their mosques, their holy books, and huge swaths of their culture with them. Because of Islam's commitment to charity and the explosion in the size of the Muslim population, every city quickly came to host an austere, male-only hostel, supported by donations, where devout Muslim men could eat halal food and bed down for the night. It was to the Frankfurt branch of such a safe house that the Saracen traveled on his first day in Europe, still amazed at the ease with which he had crossed its border. The following day, poorly dressed in jeans and scuffed work boots, he put his luggage into a long-term locker at Frankfurt's main railway station and bought a ticket from a vending machine. Already letting his beard grow out, just another face among the mass of blue-collar Muslims, he caught a train to Karlsruhe. Situated on the edge of the Black Forest, the city had been bombed back into the Stone Age during the Second World War, and the decades which followed had seen it rebuilt as a sprawling industrial center. Among its factories was one which was crucial to the Saracen's plan. While he was still living in his apartment in Elmina, He had spent hours trawling the web until he located a mosque with the exact geographical attributes he needed. As a result, when he got off the train from Frankfurt, he knew exactly where he was going. He found his way to Wilhelmstrasse, and halfway along it, saw a former corner shop. Ironically, once owned by a Jewish family killed in the Holocaust, that sported a tiny minaret. The only feature that distinguished it from the 1,200 other Islamic prayer centers in Germany was that it was almost within sight of the chosen factory, the European subsidiary of a major U.S. corporation. It was Friday, and right on schedule, the Saracen entered the mosque moments before evening prayers. Once they were finished, as tradition demanded, the imam approached the stranger and welcomed him on behalf of the congregation. Invited to take tea with them, the Saracen, reluctantly, it seemed to the men who had gathered around, explained that he was a refugee from the latest war in Lebanon. Giving a credible performance as just one more displaced person looking for a new life in Europe, he said he had paid a group of people smugglers almost everything he had to take him by boat to Spain, and from there across a borderless Europe by truck. He looked up at his fellow worshippers, and his voice faltered, making it impossible for him to go into detail about the terrible journey. I have to say, it was a nice touch, and most of the listeners, blue-collar workers too, nodded in understanding. The details may have been different, but they too had entered Europe in a similar fashion. The so-called illegal immigrant said he had been staying with a cousin in nearby Frankfurt, but desperate for work and down to his last few euro, he had made his way to Karlsruhe in the hope of finding a job. With the hook baited, he claimed he used to work in the shipping department of a big corporation in Beirut.
Inshallah, maybe there is something like that available in the large factory at the end of the road, he asked.
Nearly all the worshippers worked at Chiron Chemicals, and exactly as he had anticipated, they promptly took the bait and offered to make inquiries among their workmates and colleagues. He thanked them by offering an obscure but appropriate quote from the Quran, which confirmed to them that their first impression of him had been correct. Most assuredly, he was an honorable and devout man. Telling them that he was embarrassed, he said in a quiet voice that he didn't have money for food or another rail fare, and he was wondering if there might be one of the safe houses he could stay at until he found work. Of course, the congregation took him in, arranging meals and shelter. After all, one of the five pillars of Islam was to provide for the poor. And so, without even realizing it, in little more than an hour, the Saracen had become the responsibility. They were the type of men who took such things seriously, and 3 days later, their inquiries and advocacy paid off. A Turkish supervisor in Chiron's dispatch department reported that there was a place for the refugee as a store man on the graveyard shift. After prayers that night, the men, so happy for him they took him to a cafe for dinner, told the Saracen about the remarkable working conditions he would enjoy. The on-site healthcare, the subsidized cafeteria, and the beautiful prayer room. What none of them mentioned, however, was that all the jobs had once been held by Americans. The old Nobel laureate in Virginia had been right when he had asked if the greatest industrial nation in history actually produced goods and machinery anymore. Millions of jobs, along with most of the country's manufacturing base, had been exported over the decades, and a great deal of the nation's safety had disappeared with them. As for Chiron Chemicals, the danger was particularly acute. It was a drug manufacturer and exporter, one of the most respected in the world. Though few people realized it, the heartland of America was really only as safe as an anonymous factory in a city hardly anybody had ever heard of. In a better world, the Saracen, seated in the cafe with its laminated tables and strange Turco-German music, would have had a final hurdle to overcome. Indeed, for a time, he believed it was the single thing most likely to cause his plan to fail. Surely, he had asked himself back in Elmina, wouldn't the American Food and Drug Administration inspect drug shipments for possible contamination? He found the answer on the web. A transcript of a congressional hearing into the FDA, which told him that one country alone had over 500 factories exporting drugs and their ingredients to the USA.
How many of those facilities did the FDA inspect during the previous year? A congressman asked.
13, came the reply. The Saracen had to read it through again to make sure he had understood it correctly. Only 13 out of 500 factories had been inspected. And that country was China, the nation with the worst history of product safety in the world. He knew then that nothing from Chiron, a subsidiary of a U.S. corporation based in a first-world country, would ever be inspected. At 10 p.m. on the night following the celebratory meal, he walked along a deserted Wilhelmstrasse, presented himself at Chiron's security gates, was issued an employee pass, and given directions to the distribution warehouse. There, he met the Turkish supervisor who, escorting him past endless pallets of drugs awaiting shipment to cities across the United States, explained his duties to him. None of the pallets were guarded. Nothing was locked and sealed. They never had been. Nobody had ever thought it necessary. Then again, nobody had ever thought it necessary to lock the cockpit doors on passenger jets either. After the supervisor had left for home and the Saracen was alone in the cavernous warehouse, he took out his prayer mat, pointed it towards Mecca, and said a prayer. A child who had been introduced to misery in Saudi Arabia, a teenager who went to wage jihad against the Soviets in Afghanistan, a deeply devout Muslim who had graduated with honors in medicine, a man who had fed a stranger to wild dogs in Damascus, a zealot who had dosed 3 foreigners with smallpox and watched them die in agony, gave thanks to Allah for the blessings which had been bestowed upon him. Before he finished, he rendered one final thanks to God for the woman in Turkey who had done so much for him. Chapter 32. I landed back in Bodrum just at dawn. I had no luggage, and with a freshly issued visa and my passport, combined with my FBI shield, I passed through Turkish immigration without delay. I walked out of the terminal, located my car in the parking area, and headed on to what is known as the D-330 to Bodrum. Everything was fine for 15 minutes, but despite the early hour, I then ran into a long tailback of 18-wheelers, tourist coaches, and countless Turks blasting their horns in frustration. I pulled off at the first opportunity and headed southwest, in the general direction of the sea, figuring that sooner or later I would either hit Bodrum or hook back onto the highway. It didn't work out that way. I ended up in a lonely area scarred by landslips and jumbled rocks, deep cracks and jagged rifts. It was dangerous ground, and even the trees were stunted in the crumbling soil, as if they knew they had taken root on a fault line. Turkey was in a seismic hot zone, and there were long stretches of the southern coast that stood on shifting, unstable land. I came upon an intersection, made a left, accelerated round a curve, and knew I had been in that uninhabited corner of the world before. Even as a psychologist, I couldn't say whether it was an accident or if a subconscious hand had guided my decisions. All I knew was that, just down the road, I would see the ocean and, half a click beyond it, I'd find, figuratively speaking, the site of the shipwreck. As anticipated, I reached the sea, a turbulent mess of currents dashing against the rocks, and drove along the cliff top. Ahead, I saw the small bluff where, as a young agent, I had parked the car so long ago. I stopped near an abandoned kiosk, got out, and walked closer to the cliff edge. Safety, of a sort, was provided by a broken-down security fence. Signs were attached to it, displaying a message in 4 languages. Danger of death. Although nobody visited the place anymore, it had once, long ago, been hugely popular with both sightseers and archaeologists. The constant earthquakes and landslides, however, had eventually become too much. The kiosk had fallen into disuse, and the tourists had found plenty of other ruins equally as attractive and a damn sight safer. It was a pity, because it was a spectacular sight. I paused near the fence and looked along the cliffs. Stone steps and fragments of ancient houses descended eerily into the surging sea. Marble columns, parts of porticos, and the remnants of a Roman road clung to the cliffside. Kelp and driftwood were scattered among the ruins, and the windborne spray of centuries had crusted everything with salt, giving it a ghostly sheen. Further out to sea, the outline of a large piazza was clearly visible under fathoms of water, A classic portico stood on a rocky outcrop with sunlight streaming through it, known as the Door to Nowhere, and the restless sea flooded back and forth across a wide marble platform, probably the floor of some grand public building. It had been a major city of antiquity, a trading port long before the birth of Christ, but a huge earthquake had torn away the coast and lifted up the cliff. The sea poured in and drowned nearly everyone who had survived the initial jolt. I walked along the fence, dirt spilling down and hitting the rocks 200 feet below, until I turned the corner of the bluff. The wind was much stronger, the vegetation more stunted, and the landscape even more unstable, and I was forced to grab hold of a steel warning sign to steady myself. I looked down. Jutting out into the water was an old wooden jetty, much diminished since I had last seen it. It had been built decades ago by a group of enterprising fishermen who had realized that ferrying tourists and archaeologists into the ruins by boat was a far better way to earn a lira than hauling in nets and lobster pots. The main attraction back then hadn't been the shattered townscape or the Door to Nowhere, but a long tunnel which had led to what was reputed to be the finest Roman amphitheater outside the Colosseum. Renowned in the ancient world for the brutality of its gladiatorial contests, it was known as the Theater of Death. I had never seen it. Nobody except for a few brave archaeologists had been in it for 30 years. The tunnel, the only way in and out, was barred and gated after a giant landslide had opened up huge cracks in its ceiling, and even the tour operators were muted in their objections. Nobody wanted to be caught inside that if the whole lot came down. But it wasn't a Roman slaughterhouse or the other ruins that had taken me to the edge of the cliff. It was the old jetty that had brought back a flood of painful memories. Chapter 33. All those years ago, the division had arrived at the jetty in force. Just after sunset, 8 operatives, casually dressed, a few with backpacks, had come down the coast on a decent little cruiser. They looked like a group of youngish guys out for a good time. I wasn't among them. As the junior member of the team, my job had been to arrive separately, take charge of a specially purchased van, drive to the small bluff, and park as close as possible to the abandoned kiosk. In the event that something went wrong, I was to evacuate whoever needed it to another boat waiting at a Bodrum marina. In the worst-case scenario, I was then to drive the wounded to a doctor who was on standby for just such an emergency. I was inexperienced, and I remember that I had a lot of fear on me that night. We had come to the furthest reaches of Turkey to kill a man. His name was Finlay Robert Finlay. That wasn't his real name. His real name was Russian, but that was what we knew him by. An overweight guy in his late 40s who had a big appetite for everything, including treachery. He had been a young consular official working in the Russian's Cairo embassy when the CIA managed to turn him. Apart from paying him a handsome monthly retainer, the agency did nothing with him. He was a sleeper, and they let him go happily about his life and whoring, content to watch him climb the ladder. He was a bright man, so it was no surprise that, after a number of years, he became the KGB station chief in Tehran, working under deep diplomatic cover. It was then that the agency decided it wanted a return on its investment. They were sensible, and they only took from him the highest quality intelligence and insisted that he didn't take any unreasonable risks. They had lavished too much of their love and gold on him to jeopardize it by being greedy. He quickly became one of the agency's prime assets, and they stayed by his side through 6 diplomatic posts until he returned to Moscow and moved into the inner circle of Russian intelligence. But a life like Finlay Finlay's leaves in its wake tiny clues that sooner or later come to the attention of counterintelligence. Finlay understood that danger, and one afternoon in his summer Dacha outside Moscow, he reviewed his career and came to the inescapable conclusion that, pretty soon, all those fragments would hit critical mass. Once they did, it would be Vishaya Mira to him too. He arranged to visit family just outside St. Petersburg and went sailing in a little one-hander dinghy on a beautiful summer Sunday. Then, he put a waterproof pack with his clothes in it around his waist, slipped overboard, and swam ashore in Finland. The distance wasn't far, but it was no small achievement given his size. He made his way to the U.S. Embassy, declared himself to the shock duty officer, and fell into the warm embrace of his CIA handlers. After being debriefed, he reviewed his bank accounts and realized that, between his retainer and the bonuses he had received for every piece of high-level intelligence he had delivered, he was an affluent man. The agency gave him a new identity, settled him in Arizona, kept watch on him, and then, satisfied that he had adapted to his new life, let him slip from their consciousness. The one thing that nobody could have anticipated, however, was that Russia would descend into the hands of outlaws masquerading as politicians. Fortunes were being made as the country's assets were sold off to those with the right connections, many of whom were former KGB operatives. Finlay watched it from his home in Scottsdale, nothing too elaborate, a nice three-bedder, and became increasingly frustrated. He liked the money, our friend Finlay. He had been around the secret world long enough to have hidden away a safety deposit box with several alternative identities and to know the value of what he still had in his head. He drove to Chula Vista, south of San Diego, one morning and walked through the turnstiles at the crossing into Mexico. According to the fake passport he was carrying, he was a Canadian with U.S. residency. Traveling under the assumed name, he flew to Europe, made contact with his former buddies in Moscow, and met them in a cafe at Zurich Airport. Finlay, or whatever name he was using at that stage, gave them a taste, a gourmet sampler, if you will, of everything he knew about the personnel and double agents employed by his former best friends in McLean, Virginia. It was so good that the Russians booked themselves in for the full dinner, and another spy had come in from the cold. Finlay was no fool. He held back the best of his material, dealing it out sparingly, all the time maneuvering himself closer to those with the right connections. By the time he'd wound himself in tight, he was able to swap his best secrets for a gas exploration license here, an industrial complex at a knockdown price there. When the CIA finally realized that one of its former assets was selling them out and called the division in, Finlay was a wealthy man with a mansion behind 20-foot walls in Barvika, Moscow's most desirable suburb, and while he wasn't as rich as some of his neighbors, he was wealthy enough to have also purchased a luxury penthouse in Monaco. He had changed his name half a dozen times and altered his appearance, thanks to an excellent plastic surgeon, but the rat catchers at the division tracked him down. We could have killed him in Moscow or Monaco. You could kill a man anywhere. But the real measure of a successful execution wasn't in the obituary, but in the escape. Moscow presented the problem of getting in and out of the country, and the less than square mile which constituted the Principality of Monaco, with over 4,000 CCTV cameras, was the most closely monitored postage stamp on Earth. Finlay's penthouse, however, did offer us one advantage. Its picture windows and the French doors opening onto a terrace gave us the opportunity, by using a special microphone, to eavesdrop on what was said inside. The system wasn't perfect. It missed a lot, but one of the fragments it captured concerned a boat. We knew he didn't own one, so a quick scout around the marina, where all the luxury cruisers were moored, soon turned up the fact that Finlay and a small party were traveling to what was almost certainly the strangest party on Earth. Every year, for 6 hours before the tide changed, it was held in Bodrum. Chapter 34. Not long after our 8 agents had stepped onto the jetty, the revelers started to arrive in force. It was one party you didn't want to be late for. The vast majority of them parked near the bluff and used specially installed ropes and ladders to climb down to the ruins. The chicks had their handbags and cells slung around their necks, skirts hoisted halfway up their asses, doing their best to maintain their grip and dignity. Of course, there was already a guy stationed below with a spotlight, picking out the most sensational underwear for the entertainment of those who had already arrived. Judging by the frequent bursts of wild cheering, a surprising number of women went out clubbing wearing no panties at all. Every few minutes, some young guy would dispense with the slow climb, grab a rope, and launch himself into space. I figured that most of the amateur abseilers were smokehounds. In my experience, they were usually the ones too stoned to care much about personal safety. At least half a dozen times I saw them brush the cliff, land hard on the rocks, then high-five each other before firing up another blunt. and they say drugs don't cause brain damage. The idea for the rave at Bodrum, and the huge profits it generated, belonged to a German backpacker. He had washed up in Bodrum, and, hearing about the ruins, had driven a scooter out at night to photograph the moon through the door to nowhere. Somewhere in his chaotic past, though, he had spent 2 years studying oceanography in America before dropping out, and he remembered enough to realize that a couple of times a year the ruins would be far less spectacular. A king high tide would submerge most of them. But that meant there would also be a king low tide, and far more of the old city would be revealed. For a start, the wide marble platform would be out of the water. He stared at it and thought, what a great dance floor that would make. 2 months later, after he had examined the tide charts and used a scuba set to dive and check his measurements, he and several buddies parked generator trucks on the bluff, ran cables for a light show down the cliff, and moored barges with half stacks of speakers just offshore. They cut holes through the fence, anchored ladders and ropes to concrete tripods so that the customers could get down, and stationed a gorilla at every one to collect the door charge. People were happy to pay. Where else in the world could you party in the middle of the ocean by starlight, get high surrounded by classic ruins, and dance on the grave of 20,000 people? Partygoers said it was the best dance party they had ever known. The night I saw it, the annual Bodrum rave was huge and even more extraordinary. By then, there were 10 barges with speakers anchored inside an arc of rocks, protected from the swell. On the largest of them, standing on a scaffold platform like the ringmaster at some futuristic circus, was a DJ known far and wide as Chemical Ali. Guys in the rocks used smoke machines to send what looked like a supernatural fog out across the water. The door to nowhere appeared to float on a cloud. Only then did they launch the banks of lasers and strobes. In the middle of this maelstrom, a group of security guys grabbed a steel walkway and ran it out from the base of the cliff to the newly emerged marble platform with its 4 broken pillars. As the music grew in a crescendo, so loud you could almost touch it, the first of the partygoers, led by a dozen tall fashionistas, crossed the walkway and stepped onto an area nobody had walked on for 2,000 years. Or, at least not since the previous year's event. With the driving music, the towers of lights and lasers, the gyrating silhouettes on the dance floor, the smoke casting a pallor on the ruins, and the door to nowhere suspended, ethereal and mysterious above the water, it made it easy to believe that, if the dead were going to rise from the grave, it would be on a night like that. Well, one of the walking dead did show up, though he didn't realize it yet. He arrived on one of the scores of huge cruisers, nosing its way through the fog and mooring just outside the arc of barges. As it bobbed among other mega-yachts, the division shooters, spotters, and safety men were all at their posts. After alighting from their boat, they had sent the decent little cruiser to wait in the darkness offshore, adjusted their earbud headphones and lapel mics, and watched the crowd grow in size and confusion. Satisfied nobody had marked them, they melted into the masses, split apart, and made their way to their predetermined positions. The key man was a 34-year-old black guy, one of the funniest and smartest people you could ever hope to meet. Like all of us when we joined the outfit, he had taken another name. In his case, he had called himself McKinley Waters, in tribute to Muddy Waters, the great Delta bluesman. Anyone who ever saw Mac, as we knew him, play slide guitar and sing Midnight Special, had to wonder why he was wasting his time in the intelligence business. Mac was the primary shooter, stationed in a little hollow near the lip of the cliff, his rifle already assembled and hidden in the darkness next to him, swigging from a bottle of Jack that contained iced tea, looking for all the world like some dude getting loaded and waiting for the crowd to clear before he made his way down. Further along the clifftop, in the shadows under a cluster of stunted trees, was the backup shooter, a prick by the name of Greenberg, the sort of guy who made no secret he was going to marry Rich. He was hanging out with 2 others, looking like a group of white buddies trying to decide whether to pay the money and take the drop over the cliff or not. In reality, the other guys were spotters. Apart from locating Finlay, their job was to warn the men, whose entire attention would be focused on shooting, if danger approached from somewhere outside their field of vision. I was on the bluff next to the rented van. By accident, I had the best view and could see all the team at their stations. Hence, I saw the excitement ripple through them when Finlay turned up on time. In another few minutes, he would be well and truly going through the door to nowhere. His security team, all ex-KGB guys, emerged onto the recreation deck at the back of the boat and, binoculars raised, scanned the cliffside, the small beach, and the dance platform. Only when they gave the all-clear did anyone appear from inside. It was a group of young women, dressed to kill in Chanel and Gucci. They waited on deck while a speedboat was launched to deposit them directly on the dance floor. I saw Mac put his bottle of Jack down and slide his hand into the darkness. I knew that he was expecting Finlay to emerge to kiss his four companions goodbye, and he was going to be ready. The two spotters, worried about an advancing cloud of smoke, wandered away from Greenberg to make sure that they had a clear view. A safety guy came through the car park and headed towards the fence, ready to take everybody's back. I heard, through my earpiece, our three guys partying down by the water. A third shooter, another safety guy, and a guy riding shotgun in case it got into a firefight with Finlay's goons, talking to control. He was out on the boat that had delivered the team, getting an update from everybody except me. We all sensed that we were on the launch pad, ready to shoot. The thing that none of us knew was that a group of men on another boat, its running lights out, were also taking a keen interest in everything that was happening on shore. Masked by the eddies of smoke and the looming bulk of the big cruisers, their modest boat was, to all practical purposes, invisible. And yet the men on board had a stunningly good view. They were all equipped with military-grade night vision goggles. The glasses had been supplied by Finlay's head of security, who didn't think the Bodrum trip was any way to run a railroad. To improve protection, he had enlisted a group of hard men, freelancers but among the best in the business, to travel independently to Bodrum. They were briefed by phone, a container of equipment was waiting for them when they arrived, and they cooled their heels for 2 days before being told to get on board a boat he had organized. It was that boat which was anchored just offshore. In the darkness, the freelancer saw Finlay emerge from the bulletproof glass of the sitting room and approach the young women. We saw him from the cliffside, too. Mac let the target take 2 steps, just to make sure the goons next to him couldn't haul him back inside in time if a second bullet was needed. He had his finger on the trigger when the spotter nearest to him called a warning. Another cloud of smoke was about to obscure his aim. Greenberg had seen it, too, and got to one knee, getting ready in case he had to take the shot. But Matt glanced at the cloud, figured he had time, aimed fast and fired. Nobody even marked the sharp crack of the discharge, thanks to the pounding music. The bullet hit Finlay, but it was hurried, and what had been intended to punch a large hole in his forehead and shatter his brain had hit him lower. He fell to the deck with a chunk of his throat splattered over the Gucci dress behind him. He was still alive, writhing, but Mac's vision was obscured by the smoke, and he couldn't take the second shot. One of the spotters spoke urgently into his mic, telling Greenberg to hit him again. The security guys on board were in chaos, but the men on the backup boat had heard Finlay scream through their own earpieces as he went down, and they were scanning the cliffs with their night vision goggles. One of them saw Greenberg on his knee, raising his weapon, and yelled in Croatian. A sniper next to him panned fast, locked onto Greenberg, and pulled. Greenberg, his own finger about to squeeze, took the round in his chest and fell thrashing. I was closest, and knowing he was still alive, I sprinted towards him. It was breaking all the rules. The priority was the mission, not the safety of the team, and I was supposed to wait for control to shout an order. But Greenberg was lying on exposed ground and would be shot again and dead in seconds if somebody didn't get him into cover. Nobody knew where the hostiles were firing from, but Mac saw the danger instantly. If somebody at sea could target Greenberg, they could hit me. Screaming a warning, believing he was still obscured by the smoke, he crouched low and ran hard to intercept me and pull me to the ground. He liked me. We both worshipped in the House of Blues, and I think that played a part. but so did the fact that he was naturally a courageous man. Halfway towards me, the breeze ripped a hole in the smoke, and the guys on the boat were very good. Two bullets hit Mac just above the kidneys. But for the grace of God, it would have been me. He dropped his rifle and went down screaming. I wheeled, got to him fast, threw my body over his and rolled with him, gunshots blasting the crumbling soil all around us, until we tumbled into the safety of a small depression. Partygoers were screaming, finally realizing that two men were shot and badly wounded, but they had no clue what was really happening, or where the shooters were located, and that made their panic even more acute. Control had no such difficulty in pinpointing the source. He had been pacing the deck of the little cruiser when he caught sight of what he recognized as a muzzle flash through the smoke and shadows. When the division had set out that morning, he'd had the good sense to throw on board a set of flashing blue and red lights, and he slammed them on the roof of the cabin and told the skipper to hit it. The mercenaries on the backup craft saw the fast-approaching boat with its flashing lights and immediately jumped to the logical but incorrect conclusion. In four different languages, they yelled at the wheelman to plunge into the logjam of spectator craft in the hope of losing themselves. They knew that, in a fair race, they wouldn't have a chance, and the last thing any of them needed was a shootout with the Turkish cops. Their boat skimmed between other boats and passed so close to two of them that it shaved paint from their hulls. The screams from their occupants told Control that the unidentified boat had fled, so he ordered the skipper to turn and head for Finlay's megacruiser. In the confusion, the flash bar allowed him to get so close to the back of the big boat he could see Finlay lying in a pool of blood. A couple of the women and a distraught crew member, believing that Control was a cop, screamed at him to get an ambulance or a medevac chopper fast. But Control knew from the way Finlay was spasming and the big hole in his neck that they had done their job. He was in the last stages of bleeding out. He turned to his skipper and told him to get the hell out. And it was only as the supposed cop boat departed that the security chief realized he had just been face to face with the man who had ordered the hit. He didn't care by then. His meal ticket had just been canceled, and he was already working out how to cross the frontier before the Turks took him into a room and told him to grab his ankles because the party had only just started. Control had been listening to the reports from everybody on shore, and as his boat roared across the water, satisfied that the mission had been accomplished, he ordered the men at the base of the cliff to head fast for the jetty, where he would pick them up in 3 minutes. He then ordered me to go to the backup plan. The two spotters had heard it all, and they grabbed Greenberg under the arms and dragged him to the van. He was already dead. The bullet to his chest had fragmented when it hit his ribs, and the splinters took out so much of his heart and lungs he never really had a chance. In the shallow hollow, I had done what I could to stop Max bleeding. He was a well-built guy, but somehow I managed to throw him over my shoulder and get him into the passenger seat of the van. I laid the seat back, grabbed my jacket, and bound it round his waist to try to further stem the loss of blood. He was still conscious, and he saw the tag inside the jacket.
"Barney's?" he said. "What sort of fucking blues man shops at Barney's?"
We laughed, but we both knew he didn't have a chance if we didn't get him medical help soon. I swung behind the wheel and hit the gas, fishtailing through the parking lot, sending revelers scattering while the spotter directly behind me was already on his cell, speaking to Control on what we all hoped was a sufficiently secure line. As I turned hard onto the blacktop, the spotter hung up and told me I was to drop him and his buddy at the marina in Bodrum as planned. They had to get out before everything went into lockdown. Turkey was a proud country, and the Turks wouldn't react well to people being executed under their noses. The spotters would take Greenberg's body on board with them while I got Mac to the doctor who was on standby. Hopefully, he would stabilize the wounds and buy time for a stealth chopper from the U.S. Mediterranean fleet to come in low over the coast and extract us both. The chopper, with a doctor and two medical specialists on board, was already being scrambled and, once it had picked us up, it would head for the fleet's aircraft carrier, where there were operating theaters and a full surgical team. Mac had a chance, and I drove even faster. It was a wild ride, and I don't think anyone in a minivan shaped like a brick had ever covered the distance any quicker. We arrived at the marina and, in a stroke of good fortune, found it virtually deserted. It was Saturday night, and all the boats were either partying at the ruins or moored near Bodrum's scores of beachfront restaurants. I backed along the deck, helped the spotters transfer Greenberg's body on board, and then got back behind the wheel.